Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. When Al Gore wanted to help spark a green technology revolution, he joined up with the Silicon Valley venture capital firm Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers, co-founded by Tom Perkins in 1972. And why not? Perkins' firm made Silicon Valley the hub of high tech, backing companies like Netscape, Amazon, and Google, and netting investors some of the highest returns in history. Now Tom Perkins is out with a memoir, and he has tales to tell. Joining me now from San Francisco is Tom Perkins, founder of the leading venture capital firm Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers. He served as director for many startups such as Compaq, Genentech, Philips Electronics. He has served on the board of directors for Hewlett-Packard and the San Francisco Ballet. Also called an adventure capitalist, he has collected race cars, trained as a volunteer firefighter, and owns the largest luxury boat on Earth. His 289-foot-long yacht is the Maltese Falcon. He is out with a new memoir called Valley Boy, The Education of Tom Perkins. Welcome to you, Tom. Nice to have you here.
Jane, it's good to be here.
So from the man who transformed Silicon Valley, who launched the most successful venture capital firm in history, tell us exactly what is venture capitalism? How does it work?
Well, just before I do that, Jane, let me just say my boat is the largest sailboat in the world. There are bigger motorboats. Larry Ellison has got one much bigger.
Okay.
So anyway, we
I know
get
it's the love of your
way.
Life, and we'll talk about it later.
Yeah,
sorry for that omission.
So what's Silicon Valley venture capital all about? It's hard to believe, Jane, but when Eugene Kleiner and I started in 1972, we tried to raise a fund of $10 million. And we tried and tried and tried, and as much as we could get was $8 million.
Right.
And that, believe it or not, was the largest pool of venture capital in the world for high technology.
Mm.
And everybody said, what are they going to do with all that money? And they were right. We only ended up investing about $4 million of it in that first fund. But Eugene and I had two major hits. And we can get into, I think, how we did that. But they were Tandem Computers, mm-hmm. which is still going. It was acquired by Compaq and then by Hewlett-Packard. And probably better known is Genentech, which mm-hmm. was the breakthrough in biotechnology that really started the whole industry. So we not only did Genentech, but we did other companies in biotech. And so it's fair to say that we really did start the biotech industry.
But what exactly is it that you do, Tom? You collect money, and then companies come to you and ask them to help you start them up, to take them out, show people what they've got.
Yeah, that not exactly, Jane. What we like to do, we have money. We have it from a small group of limited partners that have been with us for years and years, and we invest ourselves personally. What we look for is the idea, not necessarily a team or something already up and running. The closer we can get to the idea, and you know, I'm always asked, is it the idea or the person?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's the idea. You know, good people have good ideas. And we try to get very early on involved in this and help create the business plan, to help try to get whatever risk there is in that idea out of the way with the early investments. So then we can just roll in the money later at higher prices for the entrepreneur and build a team around that entrepreneur. And we've done that pretty much routinely. Both Tandem Computers and Genentech were started by ourselves, and we put into the companies partners working for us within Kleiner Perkins to run them. And that formula worked very well, and we were the first to do that. We've done that over and over.
Hmm.
These days, ideas come to us through the groups that we've already backed. I mean, let's take Google, a well-known company. We had started Sun Microsystems, and working at Sun was a brilliant scientist, Andy Bechtolsheim. Andy encountered the two Google, Brin and Page, the two founders of Google, and realized that they had a unique technology. But that's all they had. They didn't have a business plan of any kind, or they were still at Stanford. So Andy brought that to us. John Doerr from our staff, partner, got involved and helped to evolve and develop the business plan for Google, then helped to bring in Eric Schmidt to run the company for the two founders. And that's how we did it.
Well, I'm curious. You mentioned that they had a unique technology and not necessarily a business plan. As you know, the buzz in business these days and what's on the minds of CEOs is business model innovation. You know, and I'm curious if you see your firm and other venture capitalists investing more in companies with great business models more than great technologies per se moving forward.
Well, I hope that we're not doing that. I think that underlying everything we do should be some risk. If there wasn't some risk, everybody would do it, and everybody would already be on that bandwagon, and we'd just be another player. But if there's some risk, it may mean that we're early enough to be a pioneer and to build something unique that will ultimately, hopefully, have an important market share. So I think that without risk, there's really not much role for us, because we think we're specialists in recognizing and managing and ultimately reducing risk. Now, when we fail, and we do fail, we hope to fail early on and not after we've got all that money rolled into the venture. So we've had a lot of failures.
I'll ask you to note some of those later, but I'd like to sort of bring you back to Silicon Valley for a moment. Is Silicon Valley still the driving force behind America's future in technology? Are the deals as hot, as exciting, as innovative as they were, say, in the 1990s, do you think?
Well, I think so. I think it's not the only driving force in American technology, but it's certainly an important one. And other parts of the country, are, of course, have developed and are continuing to develop. But there's something very special about Silicon Valley. And, Jane, it's probably the psychology of Silicon Valley rather than the money or the technology or the universities, because those things exist in many other places. But in Silicon Valley, everybody knows somebody that's made a great deal of money in a venture, typically with a venture capitalist. Everybody. It's just everywhere. And so there's just this perception, well, look, you know, I'm smarter than Joe. If he can do it, I can certainly do it. And I think that psychological tilt just hasn't developed yet in other parts of the nation, but it will.
But do you think, along those lines, you talk about the psychology, didn't the dot-com bubble burst some of that drive, some of that excitement, some of that innovation to pursue new companies?
Well, bubbles, of course, you know, I used to say I've taken every bubble bath you could think of. I mean, I've been in laser bubbles, mini-computer bubbles, biotech bubbles, dot-com bubbles, which was a big one. The struggle between fear and greed will never end, and there will continue to be bubbles. But we have a history of backing entrepreneurs who have actually failed in something else first. You know, the experience of failure can be pretty educational. And so some of those dot-com folks are, you know, are being reborn into new companies now.
Let me ask you about Al Gore.
Yep.
I just joined the firm Kleiner Perkins, your firm, as a partner. What is that going to do for Kleiner Perkins? And beyond that, what might that mean for the future of green technologies, which, of course, he's so interested in?
Well, Al Gore's joining us is not a a political statement on our part at all. We have known Al for a long time, and we greatly respect his knowledge in the whole green field. You can certainly say he's an individual who's telephone calls will be returned by just about anybody he cares to talk to. So we think that it's a great combination with our experience in the financing and managing of these ventures and his knowledge of the area, that he can help us, we can help him, and we can develop some interesting new things. Of course, he's just joined us. We're just getting started, so stay tuned.
What's your sense about the international landscape for green technologies in places like China and India?
I think it's good. We, in addition to our green initiatives, we are very carefully branching out a little bit into China. It's the first time we've really gone out of the United States. We're interested in the technology in China, and of course, Chinese are great entrepreneurs. So we have a group of Chinese working for us, and we commute back and forth to try to manage it. So I think that Silicon Valley has no priority on great ideas. So we're looking all around, and you know, we'll hope to find some that'll be very exciting.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, with me is Tom Perkins from San Francisco. He's founder of the legendary firm Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield & Byers. His firm has launched more than 500 companies to date, such as Google, Amazon, Genentech, and AOL. He's out with a new memoir, Valley Boy, The Education of Tom Perkins. Tom, we know of your successes, some of which I just mentioned. Give us a particularly difficult failure and what you learned from it.
Well, we have had a lot of failures, and as I said earlier, if we've done it right, we don't lose too much money in the failure. I think one of the most embarrassing ones, and I wouldn't mention it if we hadn't followed it up with some pretty good deals, but we met an inventor that had figured out a very clever guy to convert a motorcycle into a snowmobile and back and forth.
Yes, the snow job.
And took it up to the Sierras, played with it. It was just wonderful. The name of the company should have warned us. It was called Snow Job.
Yes.
And by the time we got it going, it was one of those times when there was a gasoline shortage and the government prohibited the use of gasoline in sports vehicles for only about 90 days. But that's just when we were trying to set up our distribution and so on. So it cratered and no more snow job. Mm-hmm. I think we did Genentech right after that.
Which was a company that you are, I know, exceedingly proud of.
Yeah, I'm proud of two things. I'm proud of the partnership itself because I think it's done a lot of good things and it's carrying on into the future. But if I had to pick one venture, it would be Genentech because it just rolled forward the frontier and enabled us to do a whole industry, not just a company, many companies in that field. But Genentech itself has, you know, saved tens of thousands of lives. It's a very important company. And I was chairman of the board of it for, I don't know, 14, 15 years, helped get it from literally just two people to what it is today, which is, I think, the leader in the field.
Technology that creates insulin for those who need it.
Yeah, that was our first major breakthrough product. We without getting permission from Darwin, we invented a form of life, a special bacteria, that would actually produce true human insulin in a bacterial broth. It was a major breakthrough.
Major breakthrough. Back to Snow Job for a moment. You talked earlier about looking for that idea. When the Snow Job idea came to you, did you think, this is the next big thing? And at what point did you realize, I am wrong?
Well, it was an intriguing idea. It sounds crazy, but it was actually a lot of fun to ride that vehicle. It was much faster than a snowmobile. You could run circles around a snowmobile. And so it was fun. But I think we should have realized, even if it had taken off, it wasn't going to be. It was no Genentech. It was a toy. So I think Kleiner and I sort of said, look, let's just sit on the money unless we can do something really more important.
So you're in a company to make money. And I'm curious, Tom, if you look beyond the short-term investment of your money, once you cash out of a successful venture, does it matter to you how well a company does?
Well, Jane, we typically don't cash out very quickly. And we sometimes kid entrepreneurs by saying, look, you can't get rid of us by going public. We'll still be there. We'll still be on the board because the public issue is just one step along the way. It's something that we've done over and over for many companies. It's something you'll only do once. We can help you with that, but that is just a way station on your way to success. Mm-hmm. So, for example, Google. Google had a big public issue, but our partner John Doerr is still on the board of Google, still helping them grow today. Mm. So we don't like to cash out.
What's the state of American competitiveness, Tom, in this global economy?
Well, I think it's excellent. I think, you know, just American productivity is among the highest of any nation in the world, just in general, in spite of the weakness of our dollar. And specifically in high technology, there just is no other place like America in the world for this sort of innovation. It's all in place. The intellectual power at the universities, the skilled entrepreneurs, the venture capitalists, the marketeers, and a public that is ready to accept the idea that exciting new products can come from companies that you never heard of 6 months ago. And that's part of it, too. So all those pieces are in place here in America.
So you really think that the education system and the level of our entrepreneurship is going to give us the competitive edge against India and China in the next generation?
Those are tough competitors. But we work with them, and, you know, Jane, I'm an optimist. And to me, in spite of the troubles in in the mortgage market and the banking Wall Street difficulties, I'm pretty optimistic about venture capital around the world, but particularly here in America.
You mentioned Wall Street difficulties. The headline of Fortune magazine this week, in fact, says, I have it here. What were they smoking? How the best minds on Wall Street lost billions. And then pictures of Chuck Prince at Citigroup, a $9.8 billion loss. John Mack at Morgan Stanley, $3.7 billion loss. O'Neill at Merrill Lynch, $7.9 billion, and on and on. What do these losses and these write-downs signal to you overall?
Well, that you can always count on Wall Street to sort of screw it up. You know, I mean, they will spend years pushing firewater onto the natives, and then when they get scalped, it's hard to get sympathy from my direction. But I'm sorry for the people that are being hurt, the mortgage holders that are being hurt by this phenomenon. But a couple questions you have to ask. Well, where was the board of directors of Merrill Lynch and Citigroup when all this was going on? What did they think these new products actually were that were being packaged and sold? Did the board understand it? I don't think they did. And so I'm very critical of the management side there.
Well, you've sat on
particularly at the board.
Well, you have sat on a lot of boards. And so with all the attention to malfeasance in the last few years, how was it allowed to happen? And yet these CEOs walk away with these enormous salaries.
Well, that's a little separate question there, which is an important one. But there are two views as to what a board of directors should be. And to a certain extent, the Hewlett-Packard Company and the problems it went through a year or so ago was the playing out of those two views. My view is that directors should direct and understand the business, be involved in the business, help management to take risks if that's what should be done, but understand the business. The other point of view is that a director is some sort of compliance officer, mm-hmm. and that if the directors are very careful to make sure that all the boxes are ticked and the lawyers and consultants are listened to, that everything will be okay. I don't agree with that. It sounds good. You can make a good case for that verbally, but I think if you don't know what business the company's in, you're heading for trouble. And if we look at Enron, which was an enormous scandal, the biggest, I believe, in history, American history, everybody on the board was highly qualified, and everything done was signed off by lawyers and accountants. But I think the directors lost track of what business the company was in. They weren't in the pipeline business. They were an enormous commodities exchange, maybe the biggest in the world. And I don't think the directors understood that. And when it went off the track, it was catastrophic. Mm.
I mentioned CEOs' salaries, and I wanted to, yes. to get back to that. I know it's a separate issue, but I wonder if you would address that, these enormous golden parachutes that are being given.
Yeah. Well, of course, they're very embarrassing. When it doesn't work out and somebody has to be let go and then they get a big payout, it makes everybody unhappy, including me. But Jane, the problem is when you're hiring that CEO, when you're in love with the idea of a new CEO and you find someone that you think is really terrific, his lawyers or her lawyers will insist that the exit payment is negotiated at the same time as the hiring bonus.
Is that right? And should that be changed? And whose responsibility is that?
It is the responsibility of the board of directors. And I don't think there's a board in America that isn't concerned about this. So I predict we will see a tapering off of this sort of thing in the future. It's not going to quit overnight because a lot of these contracts are in place already. But I'm on a compensation committee of a major company, and I can assure you that we really do look at compensation and try to try to keep it in line. Mm-hmm. There's sort of a pattern. You know, it's like the kids at Lake Wobegon, all above average. Every company wants their chief executives to be in the upper half. Mm-hmm. And so you can get in a trap there of just looking at averages. And, you know, there's plenty of room for common sense.
Let's go to the phones, Tom. Turn to Attleboro, Massachusetts first. And Ben is waiting on the line. Hi, Ben. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Ben.
It's an honor to speak with you here. I am an entrepreneur, and I'm in an early-stage company, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on something that we've sort of experienced ourselves and are hearing a lot about, which is this, I guess I wouldn't call it a duplicity, but maybe a schizophrenia that exists in professional angel investing and venture capital, where on the one hand, investors claim to be very interested in really getting into early stage companies and helping companies grow and develop their business plan. Yet on the other, there seems to be a sort of deep risk aversion, and everyone's waiting for the first client and the first demo and then the second client and the second iteration of the software. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that discrepancy.
Good question, Ben. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question, Ben. You know, earlier on I said that if there's no risk in the situation, it's probably just a bandwagon, and everybody will pile on thinking that it's going to work out exactly as planned, but you might be too late. So I think that there should be risk in the situation, and the trick is to manage that risk and probably not let the team get too big and probably not let the cash flow rate get too high before you're comfortable that the risk is under control. Now, the risk could be anything. It could be a software development program. It could be manufacturing of some sort or technology in that area. It could be people or maybe a patent situation. So there's always risk, and you want some risk. But I'm aware of what you're saying, and of course, getting that first order is a very big deal. It's everybody is just waiting for that first customer to mm-hmm. commit, and it seems like it'll never happen, but it does happen, mm-hmm. and then the ball gets rolling, and off you go. So Ben, without knowing more about the business, I just have to be very general that way.
So we heard from Ben, who is an entrepreneur, Tom Perkins, and I'm wondering about access to someone like you. How does a good entrepreneur with a good idea get to someone like you, and how many good ideas go by the wayside because there's just no way to be heard. So many walls around someone like you with your elite status and those like you.
Well,
out there.
Actually, it works better than you, and easier than you might think. First of all, we get a lot of business plans. I mean, they come in the mail, and we always read them. Well, except the ones that are written in crayon, because we know they won't give them anything sharper in the asylum.
It's funny you say this, though, because you said in your book you never financed a plan
that came through the mail. We've never financed one that came through the mail, although we always look at them. And here's the reason. We, over the years, we've started over 525 companies. They've all got managements out there. So that's thousands of people out around the country that know us and hopefully like us. And those people, that's our sales force. Those people are encountering ideas at a cocktail party or whatever. They'll meet somebody. Somebody will talk to them and say, you know, how do I get venture capital? What should I do? And that individual or those individuals in those companies already going will refer them to us or call us and say, hey, I just met somebody and here's the thing. We jump on that. We just get on that as fast as we possibly can and track it right down. And hopefully we're first, and hopefully we get to it even before the business plan has been written. They're just starting to think about it. And then we can help them and get involved very early on. So we want involvement. We're a little different than angels that sort of just drop in some money and see what happens. We really want to work it.
We have a good question from Bill, who's in Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill. You're on the line. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just wondering why any of this matters to the average American. And by average, I mean, the person who, works to make a living instead of owns property. And because from where I'm looking, I'm very, very pessimistic. I see things just getting worse and worse. The insecurity about health insurance, the fact that going to college has become absolutely unaffordable except for very, very wealthy people. And, so it seems like what we're really talking about is concerns of maybe 1% of the population that owns most of the property. So why would this matter to me?
Bill, thank you. Thank you for that question. Tom?
Well, Bill, that's kind of a pessimistic view of how it all works. I mean, I'm a guy that nobody in my family had ever gone to college. I, borrowed scholarships and worked my way through college. I think you can still do that. I think it matters in general because Silicon Valley, for example, which I'm so familiar with, is a meritocracy. Trust me, the people running these companies are not old money, from the Ivy League, polo playing and tennis types. They are from all over the world, Vietnamese, Chinese, from India, everywhere, and of course Americans. And it is a true meritocracy, and very few of these people that we back have come from wealth. It is true new wealth creation.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. With me from San Francisco is Tom Perkins, business titan and founder of leading venture capital firm Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield & Byers, and he's just written his memoir, Valley Boy, The Education of Tom Perkins. So you said earlier, Tom, that in what you do, you specialize in recognizing and managing risk.
Yes.
And I'm curious, how much do venture capitalists shield themselves from risk? Who really bears risk in a new venture?
Well, I'm not a risk junkie, I don't think. It's not that I like to walk on the edge of cliffs or anything like that. But I just think that unless there's some risk in the venture, it's not going to be a good deal if it pans out, because everybody else would have already done it. So it's kind of a simple-minded thing. Now, when we start a company, everybody bears the risk. Obviously, we are risking money and our time. And the entrepreneur is risking his time and his reputation to some extent. So I think that's the right mix. And typically, what we'll try to do is take the financing in some stages so that we'll try to put in as little money as we can to minimize whatever we think is the risk. And then, but of course, we're committed to the venture. And then we will put in more money at higher prices on and on into the future, maybe with many rounds of financing. Now, that's to the advantage of the entrepreneur, because he will end up owning a larger percentage of the company. He and his staff and the employees of the company will end up owning more of it than we do. And that's fine with us. So that when it works that way, it of course can be very lucrative for the entrepreneurs. When it fails, we'll sit down and if we respected the entrepreneur and we thought it failed for reasons that were not attributable to that entrepreneur, we'll try to do it again because that entrepreneur learned a lot.
When you think about the kind of money that you put into these projects, you'd think you'd you know, burn out at some point or at least have trouble sleeping at night. Do you ever?
Well, sure. I mean, they can get pretty dicey. I think one of the worst, if I can diverge here for a second, I was involved in the financing, was chairman of the board of a company in the satellite Earth station business, and we made Earth stations to receive satellite signals. The problem was that our customers hadn't bought enough time on the satellites, so we ended up buying a big chunk of a satellite that was going to be launched in a couple of years. And as I recall, we paid around $20 million for that piece of satellite. Well, as time went on, before the thing got launched, other people launched lots of satellites. And what we had paid $20 million for was worth only about five. Hmm. And the auditors were going to force me to write off $15 million off the books of the company, and that was going to be just horrible. So this is sometimes where luck can come in. That particular satellite got launched from the space shuttle, one of the few that did, and it just disappeared into outer space, never came back. We had it fully insured with Lloyd's for the full $20 million. Oh, so, you know, I lucked out on that one.
I guess so. Go to Scott now in Richmond, Virginia, who has a question for Tom Perkins. Hi, Scott. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for
sure.
taking my call. How do I condense this? I got my start in Silicon Valley in 1980 and spent a lot of time working in market research and product testing through the 80s into the early 90s. Back then, good old days, I suppose, I saw a lot of solid business plans, benchmarks, due diligence. In fact, that's what I did was the due diligence stuff. And so I went into partnership now with a couple of three other guys who have similar background, 20 years plus experience, and we do a lot of web development, collateral development, and we're not seeing the plans. Hmm. They're weak, and it's consistent. A lot of them are Silicon Valley companies, and we say, where are your benchmarks? Where are your demographics? How do you know this is a product people want? Where are your timelines? Nothing, consistently nothing. Now, we only have a couple dozen clients. We don't represent the whole Bay Area or the country. Mm-hmm. But I'm just wondering if you're seeing that, if you're seeing a lot of soft plans or implementation of plans.
Good question, Scott. Thank you. Tom?
Yeah, I think that the quality, this is what you're really talking about, and what the quality of the venture and of the entrepreneurs and of the basic idea, I think it has declined. Because there is so much venture capital available. There's somewhere between $20 and $40 billion of venture capital available in the United States for high technology ventures. And the investors in that pool would like to see it multiplied, their money multiplied by 10 or maybe 100 times. And it's probably not going to happen. The numbers are just too big. But the money is sloshing around and is financing deals that shouldn't be financed in some cases.
And why is that? Why does money go to
just
bad
because
deals?
It's because it's available. Mm-hmm. And if you are new in the venture capital business, you're under pressure to invest. If you say, well, look, we just didn't see anything worth putting money into in the last quarter, the investors are going to say, well, why did we put our money with you, you know, put it to work. So there's a lot of pressure in a newer venture capital group to invest. In our case, we've been at it for so long, you know, if we don't want to invest, we just don't invest. But the quality has got to be there. And you raised a couple of interesting points, Scott. My focus, when I look at a new idea or when we do, we look at the potential customers for the idea. Not only the idea, but how is it going to play out? What's the competition? What is it going to take to sell it to customers? So we want to hear about customers, 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 then the risk, and then, oh, by the way, who are you? That's sort of the way we look at the deal.
Thank you. From Boston now to Boaz. Hi, welcome. You're on with Tom Perkins.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
In your initial conversation, discussion about risk, you talked about the relationship between the business model and the idea.
Yes.
And I was hoping that maybe you could speak to that relationship. And it seems like you're really excited to have a strong hand in the development of the model. I'm wondering what kinds of innovations you are finding in business models as they develop, specifically for the internet, with a sort of new culture of honesty-oriented marketing and the new revenue models that come along with that.
Boaz, thanks.
Yeah, Boaz, that's a book length. The answer to that would take a book, but. Yeah, business model, we don't particularly want to take a risk on a new model because it's a new model. We would rather take a risk on a new product that maybe requires a new model. You know, it's hard to talk in the abstract here, but we particularly don't want or need to see a full team to flesh out the whole plan. When we started Compaq Computer, that was brought to us by a couple of entrepreneurs, and engineers and entrepreneurs, who were purely geeky nerds that had an idea on how to make a portable computer. And we got to it very early, and we discouraged them from trying to flesh out the team and try to bring in the marketing person to develop the whole marketing model and plan for the company. We wanted to just get the thing working and prove that we could do it. And once we got that risk out, then we went out and, for them, hired the vice president of marketing from IBM, maybe the best guy in the world. So we were able to bring real quality into the model a little later downstream. So I think that's something to bear in mind. Now, a lot of venture capitalists, I must admit, would rather see the whole plan than just the most exciting first chapter, but I think we're a little different.
Can I take a turn for a moment here, Tom? And I'd like to talk to you about your, well, personality, if you will. I heard Leslie. I heard Leslie Stahl in 60 Minutes say about you, quote, "Tom Perkins is brilliant, willful, wealthy, and lacking in nothing but perhaps a tad of humility." I was interested to read in your book things like when you said you attended the Harvard Business School that it was a snap, it was a breeze for you.
Well, wait a minute.
After MIT.
That was the first part of the sentence. I think the sentence goes on to say, hell, after MIT, everything is a breeze.
Yet still, you have this extraordinary sort of self-confidence. You have this ability to say that, you know, whatever you do, it's going to turn to gold. Where does that come from?
Well, you know, I'm no psychiatrist, but I think without that in your makeup, you shouldn't be a venture capitalist. Unless you're an optimist and really think you can make it happen, you're in the wrong business. Now, my mind works in a strange way. I will write a check, and it turns out the deal didn't work. Well, I don't let that get in the way of writing the next check, because I'm always optimistic that it will work. And so, you know, different aspects of my mind seem to cope with that in a different way. But I think self-confidence is essential in this business. Hopefully it's not arrogance, but you know, confidence, I think, is required.
You like to show off many of the things that you have, and you have a lot of things. I wanted to talk about your personal mega yacht, the Maltese Falcon, the world's oldest privately owned sailboat.
Yes. Well, it's true. I do like toys, but, you know, there is the Perkins Foundation, and I do give some money away so that, you know, I don't feel totally guilty about this. But this boat is, it's not just a boat. It is a breakthrough. And my idea was to, I've always been fascinated, I've sailed all my life, I've always been fascinated by the old clipper ships from, you know, the 19th century. They reached their peak in around, between 1850 and 1865, and they were the most exciting, fastest, terrific, beautiful things, really, on the planet. They were like the space shuttles of their day. And they were beautiful, but they wouldn't go upwind very well, and they needed a huge crew. And I thought, there's got to be a way to bring the advantages of a square rigger into this century. So for 6 years, I've worked to develop an automated clipper ship, which I call a clipper yacht, that will sail upwind just as well as any other sailboat, is blisteringly fast off the wind, and can be sailed by one person, by computer control of everything. And this is new. It's never been done before. There was great skepticism that it would work, it did work, and now the boat is just very world famous because of it.
Yeah, unfurling the boat's 15 sails that would take 80 deckhands an hour on a traditional boat takes you, what, 5 minutes?
About 5 minutes. We unfurled 26,000 square feet of sail, which is actually more than the typical old clipper ship carried. So, yeah, and we've had it going 25 knots, which is faster than they would go. So I'm pretty excited about it, and in fact, I'm going to be sailing it across the Atlantic starting next Wednesday. So
I've seen price tags set at $150 million, $300 million. What is it? How much is a boat like that?
I'm not going to say.
So, I was curious because there is so much out there about you and your extraordinary career, your incredibly interesting personal story. With all this stuff, with all your success, I'm curious what you're most proud of in your life. What do you hope is your legacy?
Well, neglecting just the purely personal, like my children, who I'm immensely proud of. But in the business world, I think it's two things. I'm proud of Kleiner Perkins Caulfield Byers, the partnership itself. And also the fact that when Eugene and I started, we were kind of the first guys on the block. We thought we would treat the investors very fairly in a special way, and the entrepreneurs as well. And it worked with us, and in order to compete with us, that's pretty much the way everybody does it these days. So I'm proud of our partnership, and I'm proud of the role it played in the whole venture capital situation. And then if I had to pick a single deal, it would be Genentech, because it just had everything, science, world-class science, world-class people, research, profits, saving lives. It was wonderful. It is wonderful.
And can you compare that young man who started with $8 million for that first deal in 1972, can you compare that person with the young entrepreneurs that you see out there today, the venture capitalists just starting? What's the difference between you and them?
Well, my advice to anybody that wants to get going is be an entrepreneur. Do not try to become a venture capitalist. Maybe later become a venture capitalist. And that's what I did. I really got started as one of the pioneers in lasers, and it was my laser invention that made lasers as easy to manufacture as light bulbs and made them able to be used in all kinds of things which we're familiar with today, you know, from the supermarket checkout to surveying and construction and on and on and on. So that's how I got started, and that company was a success. And then I became a venture capitalist. Mm. So,
In the right order.
That's my recipe.
Tom Perkins, founder of Kleiner, Perkins, Caulfield & Byers, and author of Valley Boy, The Education of Tom Perkins. Thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time, Tom.
It was really a pleasure, Jane.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.